Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Brian Slattery. I'm sitting in for Paul Bass, who is observing the Jewish holiday. And with me here today is Senator Chris Murphy. We have a little bit of time with him before he runs off to a press conference downtown. So it's really nice of you to stop by, even just for the time you have.
Thanks for being accommodating.
Yeah, absolutely. We should probably get right to it. I know you're in town partially to talk about gun control, and you've obviously been an outspoken... I'm trying to think of exactly the right word.
That's probably right.
There's outspoken. A lot. Outspoken in lobbying for more of it since Newtown. So this week, I since the shooting, I feel like it's been a bit of a... things have been shifting in interesting ways. So I think the easiest way to start is to ask you to respond to the statement that Wayne LaPierre of the NPR, of the NRA made.
Slightly different.
Yes, slightly different, which was that the NRA believes that devices intended to allow semi-automatic rifles to function like fully automatic rifles should be subject to additional regulation. What do you make of that statement that the NRA made?
Well, that is part of his statement. The rest of his statement... contradicts that passage by reiterating the NRA line that laws don't make people safer, which is patently false. We have reams and reams of data now to tell us that states that have tougher gun laws, meaning they stop dangerous people from getting weapons and they stop people from getting dangerous weapons, have lower rates of gun crime, period, stop. And you can tell that story in any way you want. So the NRA is, made a business out of trying to help the gun industry sell more guns. That means that they don't want any restrictions. But this is, in some ways, a very interesting moment. It's the first time in my sort of federal political lifetime that the NRA has conceded that there is a law that is not working.
Right. And I mean, that it's saying anything at all is news.
Yeah,
right?
If you concede that, then, why not join the broader conversation, especially since the NRA used to support universal background checks. After Columbine, the NRA was up in Congress saying that we should have universal background checks, and now for a variety of reasons they are against it. So let's take this opening. I mean, they are wrong that this should be done administratively. We should pass legislation, in part because the ATF back in 2010, reading the existing statute, ruled that these bump stocks, these aftermarket modifications that turn a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon,
which is what we've determined legal. Now that Stephen Paddock had used
it. He used it, and he would not have killed as many people had he not had a bump stock. But the ATF said, hey, the statute is ambiguous. We think that the statute allows for bump stocks, so we are going to continue to allow them to be sold. And what the NRA is saying is that the ATF should revisit that. But what the problem is the statute. The problem is the statute does not make it clear that these modifications of semi-assault weapons should be illegal, and so we should make it patent. We should make it perfectly clear that they are illegal.
Do you see an opening for legislation in this statement, or do you see it as sort of more like political maneuvering?
I don't know if I see an opening for legislation because the NRA is saying don't do legislation, just send it to the ATF. And I think they know that the ATF doesn't believe the language is clear, so the ATF won't do it. So the NRA is sort of setting up a potential circle of inaction here. But the very fact that they didn't issue their traditional response, which is no changes whatsoever, does suggest that the ground is subtly shifting. The anti-gun violence movement is getting bigger and stronger, and people are less willing to accept inaction as an answer. And my read on this is that the gun lobby understands that and has to take a slightly different position today than they did in the wake of Sandy Hook when they, said, we will not support a single change in our gun laws.
Right. Do you think that part of this has come about from, there have been changes in state legislation, in between Newtown and now. And do you think that that is able to exert a little bit of pressure on the national level conversation? Or do you think that they're sort of two separate things?
Well, two interesting things happen after Sandy Hook at the state level. The first is a flurry of state legislation. But as you know, that state legislation went both ways. Some, you know, very conservative states actually loosened their gun laws, and then others like Connecticut tightened our gun laws up.
Right.
Now, as I mentioned, the evidence after those flurry of state legislative changes told only one story, which was that states like Connecticut had really radical drops in violent crime. In Connecticut, our gun violence rate went down by 40%. States that loosened their gun laws went the other way. But the second phenomenon is that the anti-gun violence movement realized that, well, you know, state legislatures are kind of going to be a crapshoot here. We need to go straight to the voters, and we're going to put referendums on the ballots in states to try to toughen gun laws. And that has happened, I think, about six times, and in five of the six referendums, they passed. So I think the NRA is seeing that the anti-gun violence movement is successful in going straight to voters, and so their obstinance maybe is, you know, ultimately leading to the success of these referendums. Maybe that's part of the reason they changed course.
Do you think that there's something to be gained by being in the minority party in this debate? Are there moves that you can make that would set up possible successes in the future?
No, I think there's no benefit to being in the minority party. You know, we are not able to set the agenda. So what being in the minority results in is Republicans being able to say they're open to changes. Many Republicans have said they're open to changes on this issue of bump stocks. But because Democrats don't control the agenda, Republicans can just never bring up that piece of legislation. So they can continue to say they're open to it, but then there will be no bill that they can vote for. If Democrats controlled the Senate, we could then put that legislation on the Senate floor and force Republicans who say they're open to it to actually choose whether they're going to vote for it. But what I fear is going to happen is that they will continue to sound very reasonable when they do press interviews, but then the bill will just never come to the floor.
Yeah. So you don't sound very optimistic for the prospects of legislative movement on.
I would be very happy if we were able to stop these automatic weapons from being changed to semi-automatic weapons. I think that would be important, and I think it would be symbolic. You know, that our movement is starting to gain steam,
or even just to be able to work out a bipartisan agreement would be something.
Yeah, but I'm also realistic. I also know that, you know, right now the gun industry is stronger than we are, and we're going to need some time to build up political pressure outside of Washington so that members of Congress that continue to vote against the wishes of 90% of their constituents, that's the number of Americans that want, you know, for instance, universal background checks, actually lose their seats. And so that's going to take some time.
Right. I think since we have some time, I would like to move on to, all right, you're listening to WNHH LP 103.5 FM. Broadcasting from New Haven, Connecticut. This is Dateline New Haven. I'm Brian Slattery, sitting in for Paul Bass, who's observing the Jewish holiday. And with me here is Senator Chris Murphy. Senator Murphy, you spoke just recently about nuclear nonproliferation also in strong terms about, you know, how you feel like things have been going wrong. I wanted to ask you, actually, how well do you think, I mean, regarding both Iran and North Korea, how well do you think that the international apparatus and you know the IAEA's that's the International Atomic Energy
Administration.
I believe so too.
Don't go down those rabbit holes. Right. You know, you'll never get out.
Right, but it's an international it's a regulatory agency that oversees the stockpiling of nuclear weapons essentially. And how well do you think that current regime was working in the first place, you know, before Trump came into office?
Well, I mean, I just look at how it's working in Iran. We had a very vexing problem, the Iranian regime pushing towards a nuclear weapon. We rallied the international community to impose crippling sanctions on them, which finally brought them to the table, resulting in an agreement through which they decided to stop their pursuit of a nuclear weapon. The IAEA was brought in to be the enforcement agency.
Right.
They inspect Iranian sites. And so far, the agreement has worked in part because the IAEA has been effective. They actually did find a few technical violations of the agreement, violations on Iran's behalf. The IAEA identified them. The Iranians remedied those violations, and they right. got back in compliance. So, you know, there are places where the IAEA process works, and then, you know, of course,
North Korea is the sort of the classic example of someone who of a country that has been stubbornly non-compliant, right?
Right, correct. And North Korea is in a different place because, you know, yeah. they have a nuclear weapon.
Right.
And now it's a question of how they deploy it and how far it can get. You know, the North Koreans are frankly, you know, have watched what happened to Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, leaders who, you know, were thinking of pursuing weapons of mass destruction,
right.
didn't, and then were removed from power. I think Kim Jong-un has made a decision that he is best protected if he has a nuclear weapon, that it's much less likely that anyone will come after him like we did in Libya or in Iraq. Now, maybe there is a narrow path to a diplomatic agreement, but we simply don't have the ability with this current administration to get that deal done.
Right. Now, obviously, without holding you to this in any sort of like policy capacity, but you interpret the way North Korea is acting as a sort of essentially defensive move, that it just wants to say we have nuclear weapons, so
yeah,
you need to give us our space.
I don't think anybody could say that with certainty,
of course,
but I think
right.
you can create a rational paradigm, right? That looks
right.
nothing like our paradigm, but you can create a rational paradigm inside which the North Korean regime is operating, through which they have made a decision to pursue a nuclear weapon in order to make sure that they are protected. Now, you can't be sure of that because there are all sorts of things that this leader has done that are irrational. The very idea that he would intentionally starve hundreds of thousands of his own people
right.
in order to build this weapon is, you know, the definition of irrationality. And so I don't think you can be sure that he wouldn't unleash this in a spit of anger
right.
Against the United States or our allies, which is the reason why many of us are very concerned about the
yeah.
words that our president uses. It's one thing to make the North Korean regime know that we have a military option. It's another to, you know, call him names and to,
yes.
you know, poke a stick in his eye. Because if it turns out he's not a rational actor, then why on earth would you do things to prompt him to maybe take a
right.
catastrophic path?
Yeah, I mean, so what do you make of the friction between him and the State Department over this?
I think it's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that we risk normalizing everything in this administration, but the least normal thing happening in this administration is the open war between the President of the United States and his Secretary of State over a 48-hour period last weekend. The President said it's worthless to negotiate with the North Koreans, followed by the State Department leaking to the press that they were talking directly
yes.
to the North Koreans, which prompted the president to go on Twitter and publicly scold his Secretary of State, telling him to stop talking to the North Koreans, which then led to only 2 hours later, the State Department sending their spokeswoman out
right.
to say, we are in
right.
fact still talking to the North Koreans, despite what the president just told us to do on Twitter. We've never seen anything like it. It obliterates our international credibility.
Yes. With emphasis on the word seen, right? I mean, I imagine it's quite natural for officials to disagree with each other, but they rarely do it in public.
Well, they never do it.
You know, that's the.
So it's not rarely.
right.
I mean, you've
right.
never had a Secretary of State
right.
and a president disagree
yes.
so openly and clearly in public
right.
As we do today.
Yeah, which to me is one of those pretty important points to try to get across. That, like, what's quite bizarre about it is that idea that we're all seeing this happen instead of it happening at a meeting. Where they
right.
release a statement afterwards.
And I think you have to understand the implications for national security. It means
yeah.
that when Rex Tillerson is representing the United States overseas, no one believes that he is representing the administration. And it used to be that the
right.
only person that really had the authority other than the vice president and the president to represent the United States was the Secretary of State. Everybody else you knew had to kind of check back in with somebody.
Right.
But now Rex Tillerson, and remember, it's important to know when Donald Trump did this. Donald Trump did this when Rex Tillerson was in China negotiating with the Chinese on the question of North Korea.
Yeah.
And so it was purposefully done to undermine Tillerson at one of the most important meetings of his time as Secretary of State. That makes something that is already extraordinary even more extraordinary.
Mm. This is actually a pretty great segue to talk a little bit about hurricane relief. And just as a reminder, you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM, and this is Dateline New Haven. I'm Brian Slattery, sitting in for Paul Bass, who is observing the Jewish holiday. And with me here is Senator Chris Murphy, who I'm delighted to be talking to. Yeah, let's talk a bit about hurricane relief. You know, part of what we were just talking about was kind of the idea to, you know, the extent to which the government apparatus is kind of functioning normally despite what a current administration might be doing. How much do you think that's at play with the hurricane relief? And it's not just because of what happened in Puerto Rico, right? To some extent, our agencies are quite stressed, right, by Houston,
right,
by Florida, and now by Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. It's an enormous job, you know, for an agency that doesn't get to, it can't triple its size overnight and its abilities to to deal with the problems.
Yeah.
It has.
Well, I mean, listen, we have some truly incompetent heads of departments, people who have never worked in government and have very little expertise in the field that they've been asked to oversee. That's not the case at FEMA. The president actually put someone in charge of FEMA who was competent and who could do the job, and they are overseeing a administration of lots of competent people. So FEMA, I think, is doing as good a job as they can, being stretched incredibly thin.
For sure.
The problem is that we have other resources that in a situation like this would normally be brought to bear in a place like Puerto Rico to supplement FEMA that have not. Why do we spend $600-700 billion a year on the U.S. military if they can't muster more than a couple thousand troops and 50 to 100 helicopters?
Yeah.
Why are we paying all this money for the U.S. military if they aren't on call for disasters like this? And it's not that they can't do it.
Sure.
It's that they didn't get the order. It's that the president of the United States simply did not choose to send the military into Puerto Rico like President Obama sent our military into Japan or Haiti after their natural disasters. So I actually, I don't have... I think FEMA has learned from what was a botched response to Katrina. It's just they don't have the horses to back them up because the president hasn't given them that ability.
Yeah. I mean, so if you were in his shoes, the idea is that you would be deploying those resources basically as quickly as you could.
Yeah, you would have. I mean, listen, everybody knew very quickly what had happened on Puerto Rico. I mean,
yes,
it was not a mystery that this was outright complete devastation. And it also was not a mystery that Puerto Rico was not in a great place to handle this because their economy had been through a decade-long recession. They had an oversight board that had taken control of the islands. Their infrastructure had been neglected for decades, including their electric grid. So everybody knew within 24 hours that this was going to be a massive response. And the fact that the president didn't mobilize the Department of Defense and still, by the way, largely declines to mobilize the Department of Defense at the level that they could be mobilized is, it's really impossible to understand. And the Puerto Rican community here in Connecticut is absolutely furious about that. It then doesn't help that the president decided to start attacking first responders. I mean, part of what the president is supposed to do is provide a morale boost to people who are, trying to do the right thing, who are trying to stand up and save their fellow citizens. And when he came, after the mayor of Puerto Rico, just mayor of San Juan, just because she had the temerity to suggest that maybe there wasn't enough resources on the ground.
Right.
That does have an effect on the entire morale of the response.
For sure. I mean, it's interesting to compare her response to Reagan's response during Katrina, which was really similar, right? Just that sense of like, we need a lot of help.
Yeah,
and
no, nothing different. I mean, she frankly said she never personally attacked the president of the United States. She was very critical of the response. And you're exactly right to compare it back to Ray Nagin's response. And I mean, you could have never imagined George Bush then launching a personal tirade attacks against Ray Nagin, despite how incompetent the response was to Katrina. He did understand that his
it was his job.
It was his job to try to lift people up and to try to make this better. He didn't do a very good job of it. But this is, again, you know, truly and frighteningly groundbreaking.
Yeah. Well, I guess we live in interesting times. I know my time's up with you. So thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah. Thank you for what you guys do, and thanks for having me by.
Absolutely. That was Senator Chris Murphy, and this has been Dateline New Haven. I've been Brian Slattery talking to you in Paul Bass's chair, who is observing the Jewish holiday. And we're going to take you out with the Afro-Semitic experience with I Wish I Knew What It Feels to Be Free.